From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump supported his former security advisor's request for immunity in exchange for testimony about possible Russian ties to the Trump campaign. The president tweeted out, "Mike Flynn should ask for immunity and that this is a witch hunt excuse for big election loss by media and Dems of historic proportion." Meanwhile, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, is being called, to be charitable, less than truthful, for saying he had no contact with White House aides when he went there to receive intelligence. Turns out it was White House aides who showed Nunes that intelligence.
So as we learn more about all of this, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov was asked on ABC's Good Morning America if there was a new Cold War between the U.S. and Russia, and here's how he answered.
New Cold War? Well, maybe even worse.
Let's bring in our politics roundtable to talk about all of this and more. Joining us today, Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC News and MSNBC. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
And Maria Elena Salinas, news anchor at Univision. Maria Elena, great to have you as well.
Likewise. Thank you.
So we just heard about the Trump tweet this morning that Mike Flynn should ask for immunity. Here's what Flynn has said about immunity before, including last year on NBC's Meet the Press.
No individual too big to jail. That should include people like Hillary Clinton. I mean, five people around her have been given immunity, to include her former chief of staff. When you are given immunity, that means that you've probably committed a crime.
So maybe he's wishing he hadn't said that at this point. But Beth, a little more smoke here. Any fire yet in all of this?
So much smoke. And you know, you mentioned Trump's tweet. It's very strange to me that Trump would actually call for immunity for Mike Flynn, given that he could conceivably come forward with some very damaging testimony about Trump, about Trump's associates, about Trump's campaign. It's a great way to fight back at his adversaries and at Democrats, and to once again raise the specter that Dems are just, you know, sore and sulking still because of the election outcome. But in effect, he's saying, you know, bring it on, Michael Flynn. You can say whatever you need to say and not worry about prosecution. And that's a very dangerous place for him to be.
Let's talk about Devin Nunes. And again, the news that it was White House staffers who gave him some intelligence when he went to the White House. Here's a ranking Democrat, Adam Schiff, yesterday.
On the same day that the New York Times broke a story saying that the source of the materials that were provided to our chairman was, in fact, National Security Council's staff, I was informed in a letter from White House counsel that National Security Council's staff found these materials in the ordinary course of business. Now, that timing concerns me.
So there, you know, nobody is denying that it was those staffers who found those materials. But there's other timing that concerns people. I just want to hear another piece of sound. Nunes got the material from the White House aides, then took it to President Trump and the press. But here he is on Monday night on CNN, before this news broke, host Wolf Blitzer asked him about being at the White House to see the evidence.
In addition to going to that secure room to look over these documents, did you have other meetings at the White House? Did you meet with the president or any of his aides while you were there that night?
No. And in fact, I'm quite sure that I think people in the West Wing had no idea that I was there.
Maria Elena's picked this up because another time Wolf Blitzer asked him again. This was days before. So you're saying no White House aides. He said no White House aides. They came back to a CNN panel and it included a legal analyst, Jeffrey Toobin, who said, don't lie to Wolf Blitzer. What happens now that there has
been definitely hiding something, I think. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, your thoughts.
It's just, you know, this is still so incredible. It has all the makings of a Russian spy novel, and it gets weirder and weirder every day, and everyone trying to dissect every single piece of information that comes out. You know, the American people deserve to know, and it is the press duty, the media's duty to investigate. I just wonder sometimes why Trump is so upset about this. You know, I don't think it's because he's worried that his supporters will turn their back on him, because all polls show that his supporters think there was no interference by the Russians in the campaign, and they don't give importance to any contacts his campaign staff may have had with the Russians. But a great majority of Democrats do. You know, I think there's something bigger here. there's something bigger that concerns them, because the White House is working overtime to try to deflate this Russian thing.
Well, Beth, before we jump in, you know, people are questioning, why would the White House go to these extremes of getting information out to Nunes and he goes to Trump? And when the information wasn't even clearing Trump's claim of having been wiretapped by President Obama, it was talking about incidental surveillance. Why would they take that risk that this would get out?
Well, this is also cloak and dagger, and yet they're not doing their cloak and dagger work very well. I mean, if you think about it, I stepped back and looked at the end of the month today. It's March 31st. And, you know, this entire month, one could say, is March madness for the Trump White House. And it all began on March 1st, as you'll recall, when Jeff Sessions, when it was determined that Jeff Sessions had actually spoken twice to the Russian ambassador, even though he had said in his confirmation hearing to be attorney general that he had not. That's uncorked this whole chain of events. That determination happened. The next day he stepped forward and he said he would recuse himself from any investigation into Trump campaign connections to Russia. 2 days later, the president unleashed his tweets claiming that President Obama had wiretapped Trump Tower. And ever since then, the entire month, everything that's happened since then has been colored by this, by the claim, the unsubstantiated claim of the wiretapping at Trump Tower. Then we saw Comey stepped forward at the House Intelligence Committee hearing to confirm that the FBI was looking into Trump campaign connections to Russia. Then we had the Nunes coming forward, as you said, saying that this incidental wiretapping or surveillance had happened, and all the questions concerning that. Basically, everything that's happened to the president and to this White House this month has been colored by this all these questions and all the smoke, as you said, about the Russia investigation. And nothing on their agenda can really go forward until some of these questions are cleared up.
Well,
and even if the Trump base doesn't care, clearly others do. And his approval rating is well down into the 30s or low 40s. And people want answers.
Well, let's talk about some of the other items on his agenda, because it's only been a week since the health care bill that the GOP offered up died in the House. Let's listen here to what President Trump said at a dinner with senators on Tuesday night.
I know that we're all going to make a deal on health care. That's such an easy one. So I have no doubt that that's going to happen very quickly. I think it will, actually. I think it's going to happen.
What? Maria Elena, is health care back on the table?
Well, remember, we're not supposed to take it literally, whatever
right.
his comments
just a
are,
joke,
literally.
Right.
Yeah, it was just a joke. You know, it's just unbelievable that, you know, after 7 years of trying to repeal and replace Obamacare, Republicans didn't have a bill written up that they all agreed on. You know, it was so unpopular. It's just amazing that the day before they were supposed to vote, the poll came out and said that it only had a 17% approval rate. You know, now that it's failed, polls are coming out and it seems that people are not necessarily blaming Trump for the failure, but rather, you know, a very bad bill. Why did they have a bad bill? We have to really think about that. Also, I think that they made a mistake in treating this as a now or never situation. You know, they didn't leave the door open for continuing to work on something that was actually better than Obamacare, like they promised. So, you know, the consequences are that Trump now has to answer to voters that he promised to repeal and replace with something beautiful and wonderful that would cover everyone. And Republicans have to explain to their constituents why they couldn't deliver on something they've supposedly been working on for years. And this whole thing has created some deep divisions in the Republican Party. Yet Trump says things that are so far from reality, you don't know what to believe anymore.
Well,
and most people will think, well, if the president says this, it must be true. At least his followers think that.
Well, I was just going to say, Beth, his supporters and voters absolutely are applauding him. I'm so struck. The CNN panel that they reconvene of voters, all of them gave Donald Trump an A over the last couple of days. And there are those ads that are coming from the Mercer family, Rebecca and Bob, the big financial backers of President Trump. They're blanketing some states. They boast of 298,000 new jobs, reducing EPA regulations, greenlighting the Keystone Pipeline, withdrawing from Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it's just begun. I mean, they're applauding, Beth.
They're applauding, but just think about it. The fact that the Mercers feel that they have to do an air campaign and give this president some air cover at this stage of the game, 70 days in, shows how really they're worried about him. If he was really going great guns and great gangbusters, they wouldn't feel the need to come in with this ad campaign to protect him. Look, it's true. He does have about a 35% to 40% base that will probably be with him for quite some time. They tell our pollsters that they like what they've seen. They like the fact that he's breaking China. He's not adhering to convention. Sure, all those things that the Mercer ads are saying that he's accomplished, though, are pretty much executive orders. He's accomplished basically nothing in terms of a legislative agenda. And the smoke of the Russia investigation has permeated. If you're only at 35% at this stage of the game as president, this is supposed to be when presidents are at their peak of popularity.
The honeymoon.
2 months in, it's still the honeymoon. And in this case, he's never been above water since the day he was inaugurated. In fact, just things have been going further and further south. He's pretty much as far down as one can go. The only people who are still with him, it appears, are his hardcore base.
Well, that kind of wraps up our segment today. We got a lot there, but we should say that next week is going to be a big week, too, with a vote on the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court and, by the way, a visit by the Chinese President Xi Jinping to the United States. So we'll have a lot to talk about next week. But for this week, Beth Fooey, Senior Politics Editor at NBC News and MSNBC, and Maria Elena Salinas, News Anchor at Univision, thanks so much, as always.
Good to talk to all
thanks
of you.
Thanks for having me.
After President Trump's executive order this week rolling back Obama administration climate change regulations, the EPA sent out a press release yesterday summarizing reaction. The very first line, with this executive order, President Trump has chosen to recklessly bury his head in the sand. Oops, some lessons here. Don't hit send before you've proofread, and you can't take it back once it's on social media. Joining us to look at this and other stories online this week is Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. She's in Washington. Femi, what happened?
I've been there.
Well, who hasn't? But where'd the quote come from? What happened?
Well, the press release said what they are saying about President Trump's executive order on energy independence. So this was a press release by the EPA. So all you need to know about how this mess up happened are two names. One is a Democrat and one is a Republican. So Senator Shelley Moore is a Republican, very supportive of President Trump. Senator Tom Carper is from Delaware and he is a Democrat. Their opinions on what was happening with the environment and Trump's policy were reversed. This is how the EPA found out, and this is what they said. They said an internal draft was mistakenly sent with a quote that belonged to Senator Carper but was wrongly attributed to Senator Capito. So that was the mess up. Democrat viewpoint instead of a Republican viewpoint. And they did say that they were reviewing their team and hopefully hope to do better. Of course, Twitter had a field day with that and really enjoyed the slight change in message for an hour or two from the Trump administration.
What were people saying?
Oh, they were saying, this is not in line with President Trump. Or finally, the truth is out here. Facts, real facts, finally.
Okay.
And also, there was some debate about whether this might have been done deliberately by rogue staff at the EPA or whether it was a genuine snafu.
Okay. Well, we'll follow that. But speaking of retractions, Fox News' Bill O'Reilly apologized this week after that widely criticized comment he made about Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Let's just listen to what he originally said. There was a serious political conversation going on, and here he was being asked on Fox and Friends to respond to a video clip of Congresswoman Waters.
So what does that mean, Bill? We've been listening all morning.
I didn't hear a word she said. I was looking at the James Brown wig.
Okay, this spawned a hashtag. Tell us more, Femi.
It could be hashtag, oh no, he didn't. But the actual hashtag was started by an activist called Brittany Packnett, and she studied the hashtag Black Women at Work, which is probably one of the most revealing hashtags we've had this week and for a long time. She asks women of color to share their experiences at work. Let me give you an example. This is Candice Webber. Candice Webber gives you a little scene from her workplace. She says, the patient says to her, I need my nurse. Candice, how may I help you? Patient, just get the nurse, the blonde lady. Candice, she's my assistant. So there's an assumption there, because she's a black woman, that she cannot be the nurse. Alexia McKay says, hashtag black women at work. Being quiet is having attitude. Speaking up is angry. at Maxine Waters also used the same hashtag. She is extremely meme-tastic, very colourful, very charismatic politician. She said something very simple. I am a strong black woman. I cannot be intimidated and I am not going anywhere. Hashtag black women at work. Mm. It's really worth taking a look for this hashtag. Gives you some very raw experiences.
And this also comes in the same week when the African-American esteemed journalist April Ryan was told to stop shaking her head while she was working at a press conference, told that by Sean Spicer, the White House spokesperson. So we'll
indeed,
take a look
and,
at that.
And that story is also included in that hashtag,
right,
and those story sharings under black women at work.
We want to mention just in passing that the flyers that were posted at the Stanton College Prep School in Jacksonville, Florida, getting a lot of criticism because they told girls what to wear to the prom to be a good girl. And a lot of people have tried to move away from that, you know, good girl, bad girl thing. So we'll have that at hereandnow.org. But also a story involving Education Secretary Betsy DeVos speaking at the Brookings Institution in favor of school choice. That's her thing, when she made this comparison.
Just like the traditional taxi system revolted against ride-sharing, so too does the education establishment feel threatened by the rise of school choice. In both cases, the entrenched status quo has resisted models that empower individuals.
Well, Femi, what do they say on social media?
Ooh, okay. So Lyft and Uber get a lot of attention online anyway. They are ride-sharing apps. Mm. And Betsy DeVos used an analogy that got her into an awful lot of trouble. Picking a school should be like choosing among Uber, Lyft or a taxi. She's a big proponent of school choice and school options. But her critics online were saying, well, public school isn't necessarily an option for a lot of people. It shouldn't be a business choice. It should be a right.
Yeah, it's not as if in every area you can either choose between calling your Uber or calling the taxi company.
Yes.
And, you know, teachers aren't Uber drivers
exactly,
or whatever. So
one netizen said, well, what if you actually have to take the bus? What about us?
There we go. Okay, well, that conversation will continue. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, helping us take a look at how the news and just our daily lives are filtering through social media. Femi, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Robin. Mm-hmm.
Well, another sentiment you might be seeing on your social media is, I'm leaving. The British paper The Herald reports on people quitting Facebook and Twitter because they feel that misinformation may have contributed to their lack of understanding of the Brexit vote. They might have not voted for it if they really understood it. Social media commentator Ben Hammersley says the elections in both Britain and the U.S. created toxic fumes online that remain in the room even when you click off. Leaving, he says, is a matter of psychological preservation. Now, some people are just exhausted by their social media. They're bored with it. They're worried about privacy. So how do you quit? Jen Goldbeck is a professor of information studies and director of the Social Intelligence Lab at the University of Maryland. Professor Jen, what do you say to people who say, I've had it. I just want out?
I think it's fine to get out if you want to. But there's a few options. You don't have to do the kind of nuclear social media option and just get off entirely and never be on there again. There's really a spectrum. So you can shift towards being less engaged. You can pull a lot of content off, but you could still kind of have a presence there if you want to. So there's a lot of ways to start getting out of the obsessive social media life.
Well, so let's check. Is it true that if you think you've left a site, you may not have entirely left it if you don't do it right?
That's very true. For example, if you quit Facebook, if you just go to shut down your account, they'll keep everything there. So if you change your mind in a few months and come back, you don't start with a fresh account. Everything is there still. So if you want to get rid of everything, you have to take quite a few more steps than if you just want to turn your account off.
Now, we understand there are sites that can help you do this. AccountKiller.com, JustDelete.me. So you can get help with it. Why? How hard is it?
Well, so those sites are really helpful in directing you to the right place to start doing the deletion. But it's not always clear what deleting your account means. Does it get rid of all of your posts and all of your photos, or does it just shut it down so people can't see it? So there's steps that you can take, and there's other tools out there. Facebook Timeline Cleaner is one that I use that's an extension for your browser that will actually delete your posts and your comments and your likes. And so if you really want everything gone, you can use one of those tools and then something like you suggested that will help you actually delete the account.
We've looked at JustDelete.me. It lists how easy sites make it to delete your account. Airbnb, easy. Etsy, hard. Evernote, impossible. Why would some accounts, not want you to go?
Well, so money is always a reason to consider that, though places like Evernote have free accounts for people, so it's not necessarily the only motivator. It can just be a lot of work on their end to develop the code that's going to delete all of your content that's been there. They may just not want to deal with people leaving and then wanting to come back and wondering where their content is. But it is not a priority, right? Their business is not on people leaving. And so how easy they make it really depends on what pressure they've put internally on allowing people to get out.
And what else would you want to remind people? We're hearing, you know, some people say just go for the big four, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Google. But then don't forget you have other platforms like dating sites and things.
Yeah, I think you want to think about where do you want to be and who do you want to connect with online. So I have a lot of social media accounts since I study this as my job, but I use them all really differently. So I have a LinkedIn account that I actually ignore, but it's important professionally to have it. I'm super active on Twitter, and Facebook I really use to talk to people that I don't see all that often who I have social connections with. And so if I decide I want to get off, I may not want to disengage from all those platforms. I may decide, well, for work, I really need to have this LinkedIn profile, or maybe all I care about is seeing pictures of my nieces and nephews, and so I'm going to stay on Facebook but get off everything else.
The New York Times reports on this. They say don't forget dormant accounts. MySpace, because, you know, someone who did delete theirs was worried that somebody else might hack into it and take pictures of her from her profile, use them against her, you know. But there are some caveats about maybe not taking away everything because future employers like to look for you on places like LinkedIn, and they might wonder why you're not there. What do you think about that thinking?
I think that's right. If you really fully disappear from social media and you can't be found online, it looks really suspicious at this point because we expect people to have some presence. So I think that's the kind of consideration to have. If you might have someone come look for you because you're applying for a job, have that kind of professional presence. And LinkedIn is a great place to do that. It's not a very personal information revealing site. You really can just keep your professional things there without a lot of the privacy risks.
That's Jen Goldbeck, Professor of Information Studies and Director of the Social Intelligence Lab at the University of Maryland. Professor Jen, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And you know, a lot of people don't know that podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. At Here and Now, we want to change that. So all this month, we're inviting listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag tripod, that is hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks. There are new restrictions on what passengers can carry on to direct flights to the U.S. from 8 majority Muslim nations. Travelers now have to put electronics larger than a cell phone into checked baggage, and that has many worried about damage, theft, and data breaches. As NPR's Anastasia Stulikas explains, the ban is making some American musicians nervous.
For many musicians, their gear is their livelihood.
We need to keep this equipment safe, just like we need to keep our violins and cellos safe. It's for us an instrument like any other instrument.
That's Ross Carr. He's a percussionist and co-artistic director of a New York-based group called the International Contemporary Ensemble. The equipment he's talking about includes the group's laptops and iPads. The musicians will be using them in a performance at New York University's Abu Dhabi campus alongside pianist Vijay Iyer and his group. The performance is a combination of film and live music. The tech they need is exactly the kind of equipment that's being banned from carry-ons, says Carr.
The piece uses 4 laptops, 2 to play the video content and 2 to run the audio and the click track. And then on top of that, basically everyone in the orchestra reads their music from an iPad Pro, which allows you to see music and change the pages with a foot pedal.
Carr and his bandmates have no problem getting the equipment to Abu Dhabi, but bringing it back, they have to check it. The musicians were booked by Bill Bragan, the executive artistic director of the Arts Center at NYU Abu Dhabi. He says that smaller electronics are crucial, and not just for music. Nowadays, many artists are managing their own careers.
Their office is often the airport lounge, you know, and the 2 hours that they have to wait before they board the plane. That's when they do their major correspondence. That might be when they write grants. It might be when they are writing new material or editing music. So it's not a leisure time interruption.
The Middle East and North Africa have become increasingly important markets for all kinds of American musicians. Jazz legend Chick Corea is headed to Istanbul soon. Hip-hop fans can catch Earl Sweatshirt and Danny Brown in Dubai. Pink Martini is about to swing through Tunisia, Morocco, and Turkey, says its managing director, William Tennant.
We've played in Lebanon and even Syria and Turkey for over a decade, and all of our records have gone gold in Turkey.
One alternative to carrying expensive electronic gear on planes is uploading musical information to a secure cloud and then downloading it when musicians get to the gig. But percussionist Ross Carr says that's risky too.
Maybe you could bring it over on an external hard drive that would be allowed in the cabin. But even that would rely on having exactly the same hardware and software configuration both on our rehearsal electronics that we use in the United States and on the performance electronics.
So for now, he and other musicians are traveling with their laptops and tablets and hoping the gear comes back safe and sound. Three of the affected airlines, Emirates, Etihad, and Turkish Airlines, have announced they will allow their passengers to pack and gate check their devices right before boarding. Anastasia Tsoulikas, NPR News, New York.
This week, the New York Times ran a story about the late photographer Catherine Leroy. She went to Vietnam as a freelancer in 1966. Her incredible photos include a series that shows a Marine comforting his dying comrade. We'll link you at hearnow.org. Leroy died in 2006. A documentary about her life was released in 2015. It's called Kathy at War. In it, an actress reads from a letter Leroy wrote to her mother.
Dear Mama, not far from the Laos border, bloody combat is taking place between Marines and North Vietnamese regular troops. We go up the mountains single file, we assault the hillside, and we're shot at by Viets at the top from the bottom of deep bunkers. My film left for Saigon this evening. Kathy.
Well, the Times was noting Kathy Leroy in their series about how the Vietnam War in 1967 specifically changed the world. They called Leroy the greatest war photographer you've never heard of, and it occurred to us there might be others who took those images that changed the world. The photo of the monk self-immolating, the South Vietnamese general gun in outstretched hand about to assassinate a man, the little girl running down the dirt road, her clothing burned off by napalm, the man standing next to a tank, holding up the body of his dead child like an offering to the diffident South Vietnamese soldiers above him. Now, these pictures were all taken by AP photographers, and they're featured in the collection Vietnam, The Real War, a photographic history by the Associated Press. You can see some of them at hearnow.org, but a warning, they are disturbing, which is why they jolted so many Americans out of their seats and out into the streets to protest. The AP Saigon Bureau opened in 1950. The AP reporters and photographers were often critical of the war that started roughly in 55. They were criticized for that, but their observations proved true. When the Book of Photos came out in 2013, we spoke with Santiago Lyon, AP's director of photography, and I started with the work of Horst Voss, who grew up during World War II in Germany, asking, what should we pay attention to?
When we look at his work, I think the picture that you mentioned in the introduction that stands out to me is the image of the South Vietnamese farmer holding up his dead child to an armored personnel carrier full of South Vietnamese troops. It's just a heartbreaking image that sort of reflects the futility that people often feel in war, where they feel absolutely helpless and overwhelmed by circumstances and violence beyond their control.
What did Horst Voss say about having to see those images through the lens? I mean, you want to just take the camera and swing it at the soldiers and say, you know, respond to this man.
You know, I never had conversations with Horst about the specific photographs or even the specific feelings that he had covering this war. I think with a lot of people who document this sort of thing, there is a certain privacy. They prefer to let their photographs do the talking for them.
Yeah. Here's another one from Horst Voss, an American soldier with a hand-lettered slogan on his helmet, "War is Hell." Tight shot of that. Talk about Malcolm Brown. He's the one who took the picture, and there's a series, a whole series of pictures, because the AP office had been alerted that the Buddhist monks were going to go to the square and do something. And sure enough, one sits in the square, others come forward and pour gasoline on him, and he sets himself ablaze. This is in 1963. He did talk about that picture. He said the only thing that keeps you going in a time like that is to just keep taking pictures.
Yeah, Malcolm was a correspondent, so his specialty was the written word. But like many correspondents in that day, they were given cameras and encouraged to make photographs. So they were doing cross-format journalism 40 years ago. The particular image in question of the monk sitting there with a grimace of sorts on his face as he's engulfed in flames, that image really resonated because it was so dramatic. And it said that President Kennedy remarked to his ambassador at the time, having seen the picture, "We're going to have to do something about that regime." So it's an example of photojournalism reaching into the halls of power and through its power having an effect on policy and events.
And again, the Buddhist monks were protesting persecution by the regime of the South Vietnamese, the U.S. ally in the war. We mentioned also the picture of the South Vietnamese chief of national police shooting a suspected Viet Cong official on a Saigon street, right on the street. It was a picture taken by Eddie Adams. And after the picture was taken, he turned, the chief of national police turned to Eddie and said something. What did he say?
I think he said something to the effect that this man had killed a lot of his people, the South Vietnamese people and the American people. And that was his way of justifying his assassination of the prisoner. You know, with that image of the execution, one of the things that often resonates with me is that there is newsreel footage of the same event.
Yeah.
But when you see the still picture, that's what stays with you, that moment frozen in time. It's one of the most remarkable war photographs ever taken, the instant somebody dies. I mean, it's on a par with Robert Capa's falling Spanish militiaman from the Spanish Civil War. It's one of those seminal war images that has never really been repeated.
But more as a photo than as a video. And in fact, you have the frames from Eddie Adams, who took more than one photo next to it. And that one of all of them, that's the one.
And that photograph haunted Eddie Adams for many years. And I think his way, one of the ways he dealt with that was by setting up a tuition-free workshop for photographers 25 years ago, which still goes on to this day, where he educated photographers free of charge up at his barn up in upstate New York, and his widow, Alyssa, carries on that work today.
We read in your book that the photographers were often criticized by people back home for not stopping some of these things that they captured.
Well, it's always a difficult dynamic for a photographer in the field when faced with such dramatic scenes and circumstances. At what point do you put the camera down and intercede, or do you conversely maintain your journalistic objectivity and keep making pictures? And I think, as in the case of Nick Ut, who made the picture of the napalm-covered girl running down the road, after he saw that she was in terrific pain because of the injuries she had, he made sure that she got to hospital by taking her in his own car and made sure that she was looked after and survived. And she's still alive and lives in Canada and does activism work around peace and the end of warfare and all of that. And he and she and Nick are still close mm-hmm. friends. So I think at some point the photographer reverts to their original condition of compassionate human being.
Yeah. We've spoken to Nick Ut about that photo. Let's listen.
After I took a picture of Kim Phúc, then I light up my camera, I pick her up and, carry her to my car and from there to the hospital, save her life.
Well, they're really quite something. Again, you look at them and you think, I know this picture. There's one of troops splayed across an area on a hill. Morning mist is shrouding them. So many are injured, and one is holding his hands up to the sky. And when I was younger, I thought that he was praying, crying out to God, but he's guiding a helicopter down. Here's another one with, you just see a machine gun being held up above water, hands, and the infantryman carrying it is underwater. He's fording a river. What are some that jump out to you?
Well, the picture that you described on the cover of the book of the soldier with his arms up in the air, that picture functions precisely because his gesture can be interpreted in so many ways. It can be a gesture of prayer. It can be a gesture of surrender, as though his arms are above his head because he's been ordered to put his hands above his head. It can also be interpreted as that he has just been wounded and he is somehow falling backwards, having been shot. I mean, it's one of those images that can be interpreted in different ways. And then you read the caption, which is ever important in terms of giving context to an image, and you realize that he's guiding a helicopter in to evacuate some of his wounded fellow soldiers.
That picture, along with others, was taken by Art Greenspan. He survived the war. Four AP photographers did not: Wintan Mi, Bernard Kohlenberg, Oliver Noonan, and Henri Ouet. Nick Ouet also survived the war and continued to work for the AP for many decades, retiring just this week. Nick, bravo. We spoke to Santiago Lyon in 2013. It's here and now.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met with NATO foreign ministers in Brussels today, the first such meeting since he took office. Tillerson pushed for NATO allies to increase their military budget, saying it is no longer sustainable for the U.S. to maintain a disproportionate share of NATO's defense expenditures. NATO guidelines call for countries to spend 2% of their GDP on defense. Right now, only five countries do that: the U.S., Greece, Poland, Estonia, and the United Kingdom. The meeting for Tillerson comes at the end of a week in which he and other members of Trump's foreign policy team have signaled some changes in U.S. policy. And joining us now to talk about that is NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with NATO and Tillerson's agenda today. The Trump administration has been adamant that NATO members need to pay their fair share. And Tillerson initially wasn't even going to go to this meeting and ended up going. But did he accomplish what he wanted to do there?
Well, he delivered the message and in person, so that was important. He didn't spend very long at NATO. I'm told he was on the ground for only about 5 hours. The U.S. is trying to get NATO partners to speed up the timetable to meet their 2% goal, and that was a message he had. And as you said, you know, he wasn't supposed to be going to this meeting. It was supposed to be next week, and it conflicted with the U.S.-China summit. So initially, Tillerson said he was going to send another diplomat to go to NATO, and that caused a lot of concern,
right?
Because, you know, these are countries that want to know, where is the U.S. in all of this, and what does the U.S. expect? So they arranged it to have him come today.
Well, while in Brussels, he also said that sanctions against Russia would remain in place until control of Crimea is returned to Ukraine. Does that come as a surprise, given the administration's stance on Russia up to this point?
Well, it's also part of this reassurance message that NATO wanted to hear, and one of the reasons why NATO allies wanted to have this meeting where Tillerson could attend. They're getting ready for a NATO summit later this year, and President Trump's supposed to come. And there's, you know, a lot of concern about where this administration stands on Russia. So his message was that, you know, Russia's aggression against Ukraine, he said, shook the foundations of security and stability in Europe. He said Russia's aggression has not abated, and that the U.S., wants to keep sanctions in place until a peace deal is implemented, and then the Crimea sanctions, which are separate, wouldn't be lifted until Russia ends its occupation of the Crimean Peninsula.
Michelle, this week, Secretary Tillerson also said that the fate of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad will be decided by the Syrian people. And then UN Ambassador Nikki Haley said this week that removing Bashar al-Assad from power in Syria is no longer a priority for the United States. Has the U.S. changed its policy?
You know, to be honest, I think it's more of the same. I mean, Assad's fate had been put on the back burner by the Obama administration, though they would have never gone out and said that. It's clear the Trump administration is focused on ISIS. That's the main goal. That's the main goal in Syria. And Haley did have harsh words for the Assad regime, so it's not like they're exactly, you know, saying, oh, he's fine, now we can work with him. But they're putting it off, and I think that was a long time in coming, really.
Tillerson also announced that he would lift rules about human rights conditions attached to a major sale of arms to Bahrain. Tell us more about that, because that, too, is kind of a shift in policy or being seen as one.
Yeah, well, you know, the Trump administration, again, has made no secret that it's focused on security and countering Iran. That's very much a part of what this sale is about. I'm told that the Obama administration was the one that attached human rights conditions to this particular sale, and that that was unusual. So they've notified Congress now that those conditions are no longer there. Congress has 40 days now to decide whether these arms sales should go through.
What about the reporting, Michelle, that we're hearing about Secretary Tillerson's behavior? The Washington Post reported this morning on just how isolated he is in his first weeks as Secretary of State.
Yeah, I mean, he when he first came in, he talked about respect for the building and wanted to build up good trusting relationship. And I think a lot of the people at the State Department really welcomed that. But he hasn't been very visible at the department.
Hasn't taken many questions from reporters either.
He certainly hasn't taken questions from reporters. He's done a couple of news conferences overseas, but not much in the building. And there does... You know, there's a sense of absence. And even his supporters who say, look, you know, this is a guy who's a strategic thinker. He's going to sit down and think about where all these policies are heading and needs some time to do that. Even they say one of his problems is that he doesn't have the personnel. He doesn't have the team in place. The White House initially blocked the one he wanted as a deputy. There's rumors about who the deputy is now. But, you know, he doesn't have the staff. He's relying on career Foreign Service officers who are there and in place, but he doesn't have his own personal team that's very large at the moment.
That's Michelle Kellerman, NPR's diplomatic correspondent. And as Michelle mentioned, the president of China coming to the United States next week. Rex Tillerson will be there in Florida at President Trump's private club there, as will President Trump. We'll be watching. Michelle, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.